I'm getting the cue from the control room
to make me stop.
Yeah.
On this episode of Radio Free Dillon.
100 years ago, the monopolies took over this country, and it took a man by the name of Teddy Roosevelt to break them up and restore fairness. We're looking for some more politicians like that, and I'd like you to meet Brad Miller.
Broadcasting from an undisclosed utility closet under 30 Rock.
Issue.
American oil money and American guns. You invite me on the show, what's going to happen, okay?
The internet will never be the same.
It is so obvious that the government does not work for the people of this country.
This is Radio.
A mandate without reform.
Free.
Listen, Bobby, I'd love to help you, Jimmy.
Dillon.
Welcome to episode 24 of Radio Free Dillon. We are very pleased to welcome today Congressman Brad Miller. And Congressman Brad Miller, in addition to being from the 13th District of North Carolina, a lovely state, and I'm sure a lovely district, and in addition to serving as the chairman of the Subcommittee on Investigations and Oversight of Science and Technology, also serving on the Financial Services and Foreign Affairs Committees, known and understood entities. But here's something that you may not completely comprehend about Congressman Miller. For all the unfairness in this country, for all the corruption that I perceive, for instance, in our banking system, for all the various rigging and at the very least misaligned incentives that exist in our financial system, our trade system, and our tax system, I can't think of anybody who represents a national level politician who understands these issues and is aggressively trying to use his job to try to fight them. He's been hugely active in protecting consumers from predatory financial practices going well before the financial crisis. He's the lead sponsor of a piece of legislation to protect homeowners from predatory mortgage lending. Such an outspoken critic of pay inequity between workers and top corporate executives who are benefiting from, again, what I see as the rigged banking and trade systems, that the Wall Street Journal calls the congressman among the most outspoken Democrats on the issue of inequality. And there is no issue that is more determinative to the future of our country, to the very concept of our nation, than that of equality, in the very least, equality of opportunity. Understand that so much of the money that is being made in this country is being made in the process of extracting that capital, either through trade policies, banking policies, or tax policies. Very hard to have investment, very hard to create jobs, very hard to drive equal opportunity when the largest systems in your country are not designed to drive money into your country, but in fact are designed to suck money out of your country. And central to a lot of that is the current state of our banking and housing systems. And with that said, I will cease to speak and give the congressman the floor here. Congressman Miller, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be with you. That was a much more flattering introduction than I could possibly have hoped for, or that I deserve.
Well, you know, compared to a lot of your colleagues, I'm impressed by your resume, as you can tell. But before we get into sort of the current debate, I think it's important to put in context the American housing finance system, Fannie and Freddie, the banking system, the non-banking system, the political ambitions, the financial ambitions, the human ambitions that surround housing in this country. If you could just give us a brief education as to how housing finance, funded by Fannie and Freddie as sort of quasi-government agencies, the custody of that being held by these servicing banks, and then the ability for these non-banks like Countrywide and others to willy-nilly make home loans that ultimately still are ending up in the taxpayer's gut, even if the compensation for making all those loans was, and in many cases continues to be, collected by private individuals. How we get here?
Well, actually, subprime mortgage lending probably started out as a good idea, something that made it possible for people who really could afford a mortgage to buy a home without having a 20% down payment and without having perfect credit and everything else. But it quickly became a pretext. That idea of home ownership quickly became a pretext for really predatory lending, of lending designed to trap people in a cycle of having to borrow and borrow again, of having to refinance repeatedly. And when the housing market, when home values were going up, what that did was strip the equity, strip the increased appreciation, the appreciation on homes from the homeowners, and put it into the financial system. Subprime lending went from 8% of all mortgage lending in, I think, 2003 to 28% in 2006, and it really was just about all predatory by that point. Almost all of it had predatory terms.
How do you define predatory?
Predatory designed to trap people in debt. Much like payday lending. It was not really designed to let people get into a mortgage that they would pay off. It would be get into a mortgage they'd have to refinance. Almost all of the subprime mortgages during that period had a quick triggered adjusted rate, and it would typically go up 30 to 50%. It did not start out as really being all that much of a bargain, but when a monthly payment went up 30 to 50%, there was no realistic possibility that people could continue to do that. So they would have to refinance. They would have to pay a 3% penalty to get out, and then they had to pay closing costs on a new mortgage, and all of that went into the financial system and out of their pocket, now, out of their net worth.
I can understand how a privately held bank can, you know, come up with whatever schemes it wants to come up with, and the government should have to get in there to try to prevent straight-up manipulation and extortion, the same as the government regulates the quality of medicines and the quality of the food supply. It makes perfect sense that the government would have some very simple rules of the road for lending, even from a private bank.
Right.
But here's what really confuses me. How is it that these types of loans that weren't receiving that degree of oversight were being funded by the taxpayer through Fannie and Freddie?
Well, Fannie and Freddie initially did not do that much of that. In fact, they were taking a lot of criticism for not making as many loans to lower-income folks as the companies like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers that were buying the subprime loans from the Countrywides and the Ameriquest and all the subprime lenders.
Golden
they
West.
Were completely unregulated. And Fannie and Freddie saw their market going away from them. And they got into it. They probably did not, at least Fannie really did not do the what I would call predatory, but they did dumb loans. They did what were called the Alt-A loans, the low-doc loans.
Sure.
And they did get into it. But they were for-profit, too. You know, they were not – they started their existence at government as government agencies. Fannie dated back to the Reconstruction Finance Corporation in the New Deal, and then Freddie was created in the early 70s to be a competitor to Fannie because Fannie owned the whole market. And they were they were also initially a government agency, and government spun them both off, privatized them both. So they had some connections to government. There was widely assumed to be an implicit government guarantee that they would not be allowed to go bust. And they did have a few little connections here and there, but basically they were for-profit corporations, and they were trying to make money. They had the same motivation that Countrywide had, or Ameriquest had, or Bear Stearns, or Lehman Brothers, or Merrill Lynch, or anybody else. They were doing the same thing for the same reasons.
But isn't the definition of trying to make money in the financial services business, isn't that defined by your ability to manage risk? In other words, right. Some people make money because they're Boeing, they make an airplane. Some people make money because they work at a restaurant and they make dinner. Some people make money because they work at the Mayo Clinic and they work on treatments for cancer. Some people make money, they build a railroad, they make a steel sheet. In exchange for making that thing, they get paid. In the financial universe, if your job is to be in charge of a pool of money, whether it's yours or other people's money, isn't your job to bear the risk that you take? In other words, if the risk is attached to the reward, then I'm going to be hesitant to take too much risk because I don't want my entire institution to go under and for me to lose my job. So as greedy as I might be, listen, if I took more risk, I could make more money. I'm smart enough to know not to take that much risk. And it appears, whether it was at Fannie, Freddie, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Countrywide, Bank of America, any of them, that the business became not risk management, but risk transfer.
Yep.
How could I take as much risk as humanly possible, create this gigantic hot potato, collect the money, and jam it in somebody else's gut? And it just doesn't, I don't understand how that qualifies as legal or capitalism.
Well, it was legal at the time because it was not illegal. But yes, it was definitely past the trash. And if you can make a lot of money from a whole lot of risk, but let somebody else take the risk, then that was a way to make a lot of money. And they were making big money. I mean, yes, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, taxpayers had to keep the whole financial system afloat. But just shortly before that, they were making gobs of money. They were making more than 40% of all corporate profits was being made in the financial sector.
And if you think about it, when you look at the implicit guarantee from the Federal Reserve at the peak of the bailout with the implied net capital at $23 trillion, if you and I could go out and gamble with $23 trillion, we could probably make a couple of dollars too.
Yes, it is a nice way to start with that kind of money to work with.
And so what confuses me and so many other people is how that system came to be, and then more importantly, and I'll focus it on this conversation on the reality on the ground. The result of this was because they had other people playing with the implied $23 trillion or whatever it was. The derivative market was $600 trillion, I guess. You get this huge asset inflation in all the value of all the homes, which is at the time everybody's happy about, the homeowner, the politicians, the banks, who doesn't like free money. But now you've got a situation where the consequences of that free money scenario have been, in effect, papered over or filled in for on the banking side of the equation. But the crater of the declined home, the down home prices with that really high mortgage structure is still a huge overhang over millions of Americans. Can you give us a sense of how much of a burden all this inside out housing market and housing inventory is on the individuals in those homes and on our economy in aggregate, as people want to move but they can't move, want to invest but they can't invest? How big is the burden right now, this problem, in your view?
It's enormous. I don't have a dollar figure for all of that. And as you began the question, I absolutely agree that there's no way in the world this should have been allowed to happen. There's no way in the world that the lenders should not have been able to push people into the kind of loans that people were getting that trapped them in debt, and all the rest, the securitization, with absolutely no responsibility by the people who were selling it. Right now, we're probably in a double dip in housing values. That we have been in a spiral down of people going underwater who used to have a nice cushion of home value and have seen their homes decline in value dramatically, and now they owe more on their mortgage than their mortgage was worth, when they used to feel, you know, pretty confident that they had a nice little net worth, life savings in the equity in their home. When they get forced out by foreclosure, you've got vacant houses sitting on the market, sitting in neighborhoods all over the country, grass growing to waist high, killing the home values in that neighborhood. Half the homes in many, many markets are foreclosures or short sales. It is killing housing values. It is killing the net worth of American families, of middle-class families. We had like an 18-month period when the net worth went down the net worth of families in America went down by 1.5 times the GDP. Now, if you have seen your life savings decline by more than you make in a year, first of all, you've got a knot in your stomach, and I think as much of the economic anxiety that we see in the country now is not just about fear of losing your job, but fear of you know, what do I own in the world, and do I owe more than I'm worth now? How am I going to pay my debts? Not, you know, what is my current what am I worth now? That's a huge problem. People, it's affecting consumption. You know, I think the biggest problem with all the conservatives obviously say, oh, it's all supply side. What are you talking about, supply side? American corporations are sitting on $2 trillion in cash. They got supply.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is demand.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's buying. They're not adding workers or not expanding their operations because nobody's going to buy their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they're not going to buy their stuff is that they're in debt up their eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
They have no value in their home. They've got a bigger mortgage than their house is worth. Yes, people are locked into the home. They can't sell it. They can't move and take another job. Yes, the dislocation in our country, in our economy, because of all this, is enormous.
And all the trapped capital, because as people make their wages, instead of that wages either going into savings that could be invested or into consumption that could drive some level of economic activity, all the labor is used to pay off the bank debt that is servicing nothing other than paying off a banker who's bonusing himself for effectively collecting rent on somebody who thinks they own their house.
Yes. And the debt, the cycle of debt that Americans are in now has been, I've seen it compared to that old Tennessee Ernie Ford song, I Owe My Soul to the Company Store.
Yes.
You know?
I do.
St. Peter, don't you call me because I can't go?
Yes.
And I think that's the position Americans are in now. And we have got to change the financial system to get not just to let the banks kind of earn their way back to solvency, but to help American families get out of debt.
It would seem that the only rational way to do that is in some way to restructure the debt.
Yes.
Globally, whether I don't care whether, you know, Josh Rosner has this idea of restructuring all global sovereign debt at, for 50 years at 50 basis points and then letting that trickle through the entire system. I don't know whether that's the right idea. I don't know whether people talk about doing principal write downs on these mortgages.
That would help. I mean,
how would you approach the issue of reducing the cost of this debt?
I have just about pulled my hair out. I introduced the first bankruptcy modification bill in Congress. The industry was able to defeat that. I think that would have been a big help. It wouldn't have solved the whole problem. It probably would have reached only 20 to 25% of the underwater homeowners that would have been able to get out of the mortgage they're in and to get into one they could afford through bankruptcy in a very logical, orderly way. That got defeated. I proposed using something similar to the Homeowners Loan Corporation, the HOLC, that worked very successfully in the New Deal to get the middle class to help them save their homes when they were in mortgages they couldn't afford and stop the foreclosure crisis during the Great Depression. That would have required using probably condemnation powers, eminent domain powers, to buy the mortgages. I proposed using the rulemaking under Dodd-Frank, particularly what's called the risk retention or the into the game rules to require that servicers have to modify when people get into trouble and to provide clear standards for how they modify. But until we get something in place that is not entirely voluntary for the banks, we just are not going to get an orderly resolution of the household debt tied up in mortgages. And people just feel tormented, like they're a mouse captured by a cat. I mean, they are in torment over mortgages they cannot pay and cannot get out of, and they keep getting offered modifications that just build their missed payments into the principal or pushes them back at the back end of the loan, but doesn't get them into something they can afford that helps them actually have some equity in a home.
What confuses people, and you talk to, you know, pretty much anybody in this country who doesn't run a bank, and they will either entirely or largely agree with most of what you or myself or quite honestly any other person with common sense would say about this, that basically that an economy that is predicated on trapping people in underwater homes because it's profitable for a group of people that give a lot of money to politicians is blatantly insane. At the same time, no matter how much you carry on about it in the free press or no matter how much a congressman like yourself tries to work on this, it is readily apparent that the financial industry, however small a group of people it may be, has tremendously more leverage over the what the government does than everybody else in America, which I think people find phenomenally frustrating, disempowering, and incredibly discouraging, if not openly creating despondence among people. Do you have any insight as to how it is that the you know 80 to 90% majority of Americans could actually get the leverage to do this?
Well, I think you've hit upon a big part of the problem, and that is that the system has become so complicated that it is easy for the banks and for the bank lobbyists and the banks' PR people just to kind of fuzz it all up. And I think the simple explanation is the right one. One of my favorite lines from Will Rogers was early in the New Deal, he said that President Roosevelt had explained the banking crisis so clearly that even the bankers understood it. And I think that's the kind of explanation we need now, something that is not all in credit default swaps and all of the other complication that makes any normal human being's eyes glaze over, but is fairly straightforward. The banks have trapped people in debt. They can't pay it. And instead of dealing with it in a way that realizes, makes the banks recognize the losses that they've got, keeps people trapped in debt until the banks can get in better shape themselves.
And the only thing I would add to that is the banks got people trapped in debt by lending money that the banks didn't have. It wasn't the bank's money.
Well, yes, they sold the debt. They sold it quickly to probably...
To your retirement fund, the retirees' retirement fund.
To pension funds, and I'm told...
Come on, it's a joke.
Yeah. There's no telling where this stuff is now. It's all over the
world. It's absurd. What are you hoping for from the Consumer Financial Protection Board?
I think there are plenty of powers in that board. First of all, going forward, the Dodd-Frank Act did have pretty good... I should say very good. The bill had a strong consumer protection for mortgage lending. And I think it's easy to say, oh, well, you know, mortgage lending, you take that off the table, the banks will come up with something else. No, they're not going to come up with anything else like mortgage lending. All other consumer debt is $2.6 trillion. Mortgage lending is like $11 to $14 trillion. If mortgage lending is solid and is not predatory, that's going to be an enormous protection of our financial system as a whole.
Going forward.
Going forward.
Yep.
The new risk retention rules, the skin in the game rule, that if you're the bank that bought the mortgages and put them in a pool and then sold bonds based on the pool, you've got to keep 5% of the risk. Well, all the economic studies are that's pretty damned effective, that banks are going to be really careful about what they buy if they know they're not going to be able to sell all of it.
Between you and me, that was, although it's a podcast, it's absurd it wasn't already like that.
Yes, it is.
Water under the bridge. Anyway, we'll carry on.
And the various financial regulators are now debating the rules that the provision in the statute that allows exceptions to that. Who's not subject to that skin in the game requirement? And we've got to make sure that that's rock solid, and we've got to make sure, because the experience in this area is what sounds like a modest little reasonable exception ends up swallowing the rule. There is no rule less, it's all exception.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to make sure those are really tough exceptions. Josh Rosner, who you mentioned a moment ago, has been part of that. I've been part of that, urging the regulators to come up with some tough requirements for any exception to that, and to require, as part of that, that the banks, how they treat the mortgages, how they modify mortgages that get in trouble, has to be part of that.
Your thoughts, we mentioned Josh, but there's a whole string of folks who are both, I think, very well-intentioned in terms of the most basic principles of fairness and equity in this country going back, you know, hundreds of years, and also those who work more in the communications universe, the financial blogs and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
How important is everybody from Chris Whalen and Josh Rosner to Zero Hedge and Naked Capitalism and the like?
Well, I read most of those. Zero Hedge strikes me well. I read Naked Capitalism. I talk to Josh, and I know who Chris Whalen is, and I usually get Chris Whalen kind of filtered through Josh. What I found when I first started working on this, there was some expertise available specifically on mortgages among consumer groups. When the financial crisis hit, I couldn't find anybody who could tell me anything because everyone who really knew what had happened in the financial system in the last 20 years hadn't learned about it in school. They had been in the financial system. So mm-hmm. I couldn't find anybody who wasn't part of the financial system to give me any expertise to work from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was sitting at my home computer in September of 2008 reading on Wikipedia about credit default swaps. And I'm one of the more conscientious members of the financial
right. You've got a historical investment in American housing finance.
Right. So if that's how at sea I was, I mean, I can tell you that nobody in Congress knew all that was going on, had a clue what was going on, and that was quite intentional. They didn't want us to have a clue. I think we have now developed sources of expertise. We have identified experts, economists, people like Josh. A good number of folks. The economics blogosphere, as you mentioned, has really come alive. They know who the experts are. It is possible to get help with something now that I can tell you 2.5 years ago was just not available to anybody involved in politics who actually had a reform agenda.
Yeah, and to that end, as with this my recently launched Steel on Wheels tour, where we basically take our show out into various cities in the country, I've had the opportunity to really learn more myself about everything from women's suffrage to the populist movement coming out of Nebraska in the 1890s, right. Down the list. And the one thing that strikes me is that, listen, unfairness between special interests and the government is as old as America. And the movements that come together to reform things, whether it was Teddy Roosevelt or Susan B. Anthony, you pick them, take time because the educational curve is meaningful. People are distracted. And quite honestly, they don't really want to believe that it's as unfair or that it's as rigged as it may ultimately turn out to be. Where do you think we are in the reform movement of financial fairness and real investment, a culture of real investment and real risk-taking being attached to reward in this country?
The financial industry obviously still has enormous power. There is now a set of folks who have looked at it, who do understand it better and think that it needs to be fixed. And I recently read, I don't know why, but I recently read Teddy Roosevelt's New Nationalism speech, one of his favorite, one of his famous speeches in 1910. You should read that. It could have been yesterday, except that he talks about the power of the railroads.
Sure,
railroads don't have so much power nowadays, but the corporate power, the power of property of interest, the influence of money in politics, all of that. It could have been a speech given today. And that was truly the progressive point of view at the time. The point of view that progressives are taking on economic issues now is really indistinguishable from the point of view of literally 100 years ago. That was in the summer of 1910. It could just as easily have been given today.
And I most definitely will look that up. I will tell you, just having come back from Nebraska a couple of days ago, the issues are identical.
Yeah. Nebraska was William Jennings Bryan's territory, and I don't know enough of my history of that period to know all the nuances between the populist and the progressive.
But the issue of concentrated wealth and power coming at the benefit of one group and at the expense of another group as a representation of the culture of unfairness in a country that claims fairness is foundational to what Teddy Roosevelt was doing, and I would think will be foundational to some of the politics over the next decade.
I hope so. I think it needs to be the case. We have had periods like this in our history. Theodore Roosevelt, the Progressive Era, the New Deal, actually Lincoln and Andrew Jackson's administration, when we really did have, through the political system, take on the economic power that was also controlling the government. And I think that needs to be the defining issue in our politics for the next generation. And another important point from that Theodore Roosevelt speech was he didn't just talk about redistributive justice, about progressive taxation, although he called for that and for an estate tax to prevent passing down enormous wealth.
Sure.
But the idea that you have to do something to earn it, that you actually have to be doing something useful.
Exactly. Productive capital.
Productive. And his view was that people, and during that period, and he was right, were making their fortunes not by doing something productive, but by getting themselves in a position to manipulate the economy. Rent-seeking economists now. And I think that is, again, as true today as it was in 1910.
Hear, hear, Congressman. We are lucky to have you in our federal government, and certainly the 13th District in North Carolina, fortunate to have somebody who has made the investment that you've obviously made in not only understanding these issues, but advocating around them. It's a true pleasure for me to have the opportunity to speak with you here, and I know that our listeners will be thrilled to hear that a man like yourself is not only exists, but is working on the behalf of all of us that look to someone like Teddy Roosevelt and that basic fairness agenda, which we view as not a left-right issue, but as a cheat-or-compete issue, one that is really central to what we're doing here. So you certainly have our full support. Well, and once again, I thank you so much for your time.
Shucks. Thanks.
All right. Congressman Brad Miller. And we'll be right back in 30 seconds.
More Radio Free Dillon after this.
Market's got you down? Worried about your investments? Hi, I'm Guy Adami, and I'm here to help you jump back into the markets. Get the education you need by downloading a free investment white paper or attend a free educational webinar from Trade Monster. Learn how to protect your portfolio, become a smarter investor, and start testing the market waters. It's time to sign up. To learn more or to sign up, visit www.trademonster.com/Radigan.
Brought to you by Trade Monster.
Back to Radio Free Dylan.
Welcome back to Radio Free Dylan. That was kind of fun, right? Finding a congressman who actually understands and is invested in understanding the core financial corruption that is at the root of the joblessness in this country, that is at the root of the unfairness in this country, that is at the root of the lack of innovation and creativity in this country, because the very same issues that plagued our country 100 years ago plague ourselves once again. What are those issues? Well, you've got an extraordinary series of innovations. In Teddy Roosevelt's case, it was the Industrial Revolution, the advent of the railroad, the advent of so-called modern banking at that point in time. And as a result of that, you had the benefits of the rails and the benefits of a credit system. And at the same time, because you had such consolidated wealth and power and the ability to control the government, you suddenly watched the farmers, the small businesses, so many Americans being subjected to basically debtor's prison at the hands of the monopolies. So it's not like we haven't been here before. What does that give rise to? Not just the populist movements and everything that came out of Nebraska, but ultimately the consolidation of the reformers in the Republican Party, which is where Teddy Roosevelt was, and the populists on the simple basic meme of fairness, equal opportunity, and the obvious understanding that those who can manipulate their position inside of the banking and trade systems to make themselves wealthy while oppressing the people is simply un-American. We find ourselves here once again. We find ourselves once again in search of a Teddy Roosevelt, of a Bull Moose Party that is not vested in hanging on to legacy lefty-righty talking points. Remember, when the populists emerged, the Democrats and the Republicans of the 1890s were still fighting the Civil War from the 1860s. So while the monopolies consolidated wealth, the Democrats and the Republicans were going back and forth playing North-South games that the vast majority of the American people had gotten over 30 years ago. It took the populists out of Nebraska to say, hey, hey, this is not fair, this is not America, and the people that are taking all this money out in the Gilded Age, Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, etc., are doing it by corrupting the most basic foundational aspects of this country. Remember, back then, this country was very fearful of becoming a monarchy, much as the monarchy that it had fled only 100 years prior to that. Well, unfortunately, we now have another 100 years behind us. We have another major technological revolution, the digital revolution, that is resulting in massive consolidation of wealth and power inside of a couple of industries, most notably the banking industry, who's using technology to basically synthetically fabricate money into the future that they warehouse on a computer and then give it out to you on your credit card. And we are desperately in need, once again, of Teddy Roosevelt. Not a lefty, not a righty, somebody who speaks simple, easy to follow, Americanese, who says, you're not making that money, sir, and we as the government have the right to stop you from taking our money and demand that if you want to be in charge of money at all, you have to invest it in this country. I present to you Brad Miller as the first of what I hope will be many men who will look to Teddy Roosevelt and that value system for their politics over the next decade in this country. I thank you for taking a moment to listen to us this afternoon on Radio Free Dylan, and we'll talk to you next time.